Hello, I'm Emma Martins, and you're listening to The Longest Battle here on RNIB Connect Radio. The reason I decided to do The Longest Battle is because I caught a virus in 2013, which changed my life forever. As a result, I've pretty much had to relearn everything again, from crossing a road to making a cup of tea. So I decided I'd talk to other people who have gone through life-changing situations. Today, my guest is the incredible David Butler, who at the age of 11, in 1955, who lost most of both of his legs and his left hand after coming across an unexploded bomb. The life-changing injuries from this accident have certainly not stopped David from achieving so much in his own life through motorsport. I began by asking David about the accident and how it affected his early life.
When I was 11 years old, my parents took me on a picnic in 1955 to Ivanhoe Beacon, which was a National Trust ground. And I could really run in those days, and I ran up to the top of the beacon and I looked down into fields nearby, and on a gatepost I saw what I thought was a very large rusty tin can. So I rushed down to it. A friend of mine was behind me. I got there first, picked it off the fence, but it was so heavy I dropped it, and the explosion was heard 7 miles away. It was an old mortar bomb, In the war, Ivanhoe Beacon was a training ground for soldiers to use mortars. Right. And of course, in the emergency of a war, they don't worry whether they've gone off or not. They just want to train the soldiers and get them on the front line. So a lot of these munitions were left. And although the National Trust, a few years later, after the war, had declared the beacon to be clear of munitions, It obviously wasn't. And many years later, I went down to Blackdown Barracks for a conference there, and I met a Colonel Green, and he came up to me and said, "David, were you injured at Ivanhoe Beacon?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I was in charge of checking for other unexploded bombs on the beacon."
Goodness.
And I closed the beacon for 5 months, and I found 57 more unexploded munitions.
Oh, my goodness.
So I did quite a good job of clearing the beacon for everyone.
Wow, that's scary.
But I lost my left leg below the knee. My right leg was some yards away. It was blown off above the knee. And I lost my left hand, which was a bit of a problem because I was left-handed. That's my excuse for having terrible handwriting ever since, when I learned to write with my right hand.
Oh, goodness me. So, obviously, I've been in hospital for quite a long time. So tell me, how long can you remember about? Because how old were you at the time?
I was 11.
11.
At the time. And the nearest hospital to the beacon, which had intensive care facilities, was at Luton and Dunstable. And so that was where I was taken. The bomb actually didn't knock me out. I got zinging in my ears because my eardrums had been blown out with the blast. And I can remember my dad kneeling near me and talking to me. But actually, I wouldn't be talking to you today if it wasn't for a doctor, Dr. Pinkerton, and his wife, who was a nurse, who were picnicking on the beacon. And both had had experience of explosions in the war. And they heard it go off, knew exactly what it was, and got to me immediately. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking to you.
Right.
But it didn't knock me out at that point. I could hear the zinging in my ears, and I could hear my dad talking to me. But then after that, I didn't come round for about another 3 or 4 weeks in intensive care. And I had the most wonderful Sister Beryl Ash look after me during the whole of that period of time.
How long were you actually in hospital for?
In total, over 2 years.
2 years?
Yes.
Goodness.
Wow. I started off in Luton and Dunstable, where they completed the amputations. And I was there for 5 or 6 months. And then I had to move to Mount Vernon for skin grafting.
Okay.
Because in the early days, I'd contracted gangrene twice in my left leg.
Right.
Which is where my knee was, which was vital to save that knee.
And the
skin was not sufficient over the stump for me to put my weight on it when I eventually would get my artificial limbs.
Mm.
So I was taken to Mount Vernon, and I had 16 operations in 17 months, mainly to move a huge amount of skin from the right side of my chest in a pedicle, which is like a tube. It almost looked like a handle on the side of me. I didn't appreciate a comment by a surgeon that he could put a spout the other side and they can pour me.
Oh, we don't want that.
It took a long time to transfer from my side via my arm, then to my leg, and then wrap it round so that I had a thick layer of skin that I could stand on. But I did realise how vital it was for me to have one knee for walking, swimming, everything else. It was vital.
Before we find out how David got into motorsport and what it was like for him competing and winning many races, I wanted to find out from David what the main obstacles have been for him.
I didn't really think about obstacles. I knew that I wouldn't be able to do all the things that I had as a youngster, playing football, running around. And I think you come to a realisation very early on that there are limitations, but then there are other advantages that you can gain from a disability. I think probably the biggest challenge was actually getting around. And I was frustrated as a teenager as well. And when I went back to school, of having to be responsible or reliant upon other people to give me lifts from friends or have taxis or whatever. And I found that enormously frustrating until eventually I was able to drive.
Mm. So how were your teenage years?
Well, when I was injured on a Sunday, on the Monday morning, my 11 plus positive results dropped through the letterbox while I was in intensive care. And the headmaster, John Robinson, a wonderfully supportive headmaster at Hemel Hempstead Grammar School, held that place open for me for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until his 80th birthday party that I found out actually he had a metal plate in his back and was injured in the war himself.
Right.
Enormously supportive.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed my teenage years in the Hemel Grammar School. And it was there, actually, that I met my future wife.
It's fantastic.
When I was waiting for a taxi at the school.
Uh-huh. Oh, fantastic. So how did you get into motorsports?
When I was in Luton and Dunstable Hospital in intensive care, alongside me in an iron lung was a young scout. And he had climbed over the barrier at Whipsnade Zoo into the lion's den, and the lion had captured him and ripped both his arms off at the shoulder. And he was in an iron lung next to me. And a Daily Express reporter called Frank Goldsworthy came along to write the story about the scout.
Mm.
And while he was there, Frank was originally the war correspondent for the Daily Express. So Sister Beryl Ash mentioned that I had bomb injuries, and he was very, very interested and came to see me and chatted to me. And in his autobiography, there is a whole chapter that's called when he referred to me as gaining a best friend for life.
Amazing.
Wonderful guy.
Yeah.
And
what a story. Oh, my goodness.
And then
wow.
He came to visit me quite regularly. And just when I'd finished all my operations in Mount Vernon Hospital, and I was about to be transferred to Roehampton to get fitted with legs. Mm. Frank came along, and I used to call him Uncle Frank by then. He came along with a wheelchair, popped me in it, and took me to Silverstone. Uh-huh. Because the Daily Express ran a Formula One meeting there. And, oh, a 13-year-old going to Silverstone was quite something. And I, because Frank, of course, had a press pass, we went on the grid. I met Stirling Moss, Mike Hawthorne.
Wow.
And they sat me in a Formula One car. And it was so exciting. And that day really started a lifelong love affair with motor racing. And I saw that day also who was really the first successful disabled driver, a guy called Archie Scott Brown. Okay. And Archie was born with deformity of both legs and an arm. But he was determined to race. And he, after many, many operations, he was driving, he started to race, and he was renowned for his skillful control of big Lister Jaguars. And I saw him that day drift this V8 Lister through Woodcote Corner, and it was so exciting. And I thought, wonderful, that really is something I want to do. And I made that an objective, and I never wavered from it. I was going to race.
Life objective, basically.
It was, yes. But what I didn't know was it was going to take me another 30 years before I could get a full race licence. One of the reasons for that was, regrettably and very sadly, 2 years after I saw Archie at Silverstone, he died at Spa in a race. It was a wet race, and he went, and it's a road circuit, and he went slightly offline while racing with his great friend Maston Gregory in another Lister Jag, and he somersaulted the car and burnt to death in it. The anti-disability brigade, who were very vocal and numerous at the time, stated that it was his disability that caused the accident. Quite wrongly, because his driving was impeccable. But they changed the rules then and brought in really draconian rules, which stayed in place and virtually excluded disabled drivers from motor racing for the next 30 years, until I changed those rules and challenged them.
Fantastic. And you changed that. That's amazing.
Yes.
That's amazing. So racing is still pretty dangerous.
Well, that's the excitement. If it wasn't dangerous, we wouldn't bother doing it, would we? It gets the adrenaline going to race. And really, that is driving on the limit. And if you go over the limit, you have a problem. Mm. It is. I found rally driving, actually, because I did two world championships rallies and some international historic rallies. But I found that was very dangerous and also very expensive.
Yeah.
I wrote
my
historic Porsche 911 off by hitting a wall and then a tree at 70.
Oh, my goodness. My ex enjoyed rally driving.
Yeah.
It is pretty scary.
Oh, yeah. And it's very expensive.
Yeah.
When we did the UK round of the World Championship, I had 12 people in my crew.
Yeah.
We had a van full of spares, my wife and my younger daughter running the cafe car, feeding us all, and then a chase car behind me. And, of course, by the time you've gone all around the country, hotels and everything else, it's a very, very expensive game.
Yeah.
So after I wrote the Porsche off, I thought I'd go back to motor racing, where we're all going the same way. The trees and the banks are a bit further back, and it's the same every lap. So I thought that was a bit more safe.
Now we know a little bit more about what obstacles David has faced in his life. I wanted to know what have been his biggest achievements.
It's not on the track, although I've won many classes. I got driver of the day. I've held two lap records. But I ignore those, really, because I think my greatest achievement was changing the rules for motor racing to enable disabled drivers to take part. And that took me from when I was 17 to when I was 47, exactly 30 years to change those rules that had been put in place after Archie's demise on the track. I could do any motorsport event where there was only one car at a time on the circuit. In other words, I could do rallies, sprints, hill climbs, those sort of high-speed events, sometimes on circuits as well, but not a mass grid start, and that's really what I wanted to do. And I did over 500 of these events.
Wow.
I went to the MSA, the Motorsport Association, who are the governing body in the UK, to request my licence, and it got turned down 14 times. It got turned down 14 times. You could call that persistence, I suppose, or stubbornness, but I was determined that I was going to race. Yeah. But after all these events, and I'd won a lot of events, I won my class in the London Autocross Championship racing on grass. But they ignored all this and said, no, you've got arms and legs missing, you can't do motor racing with a mass grid start with other drivers. But I wouldn't accept that. And so I joined the British Motorsport Association for the Disabled, BMSAD, of which I've been the chairman for over 20 years now. I'm now president of it. But then I took the MSA to the European courts under the Treaty of Rome for discrimination, because in none of their assessments was the ability of the disabled driver to race taken into account. Therefore, it was clear discrimination. And when they appointed a QC, it took him very little time to tell them, David will win, so talk to him about it. And they did so, and I set up the very first assessment centre to assess disabled drivers' ability at Silverstone. And there were three of us who did the first test. And between us, we had five limbs, and one guy had an eye missing as well. There's only three of us, and we all got our licences. I raced against the Formula 5000 champion alongside me in my little sports racing car.
Yeah.
And it was slightly damp, and he was pushing me onto the damp parts of the circuit to make certain I could control the car. But I received my license then and went on very shortly afterwards to do 24 races in that year.
Fantastic.
But when I was setting up the assessment, one of the criteria, and it always has to be the number one criteria in motorsport, and that's safety. And it isn't just the safety of the driver. I say to disabled drivers when they come to me to discuss taking part, that it isn't just their safety. If they're daft enough to put a helmet on and get into a car, that's fine. I do have a responsibility to make certain they can get out of it in time and it's as safe as possible with the controls and adaptations they need. But there are other factors. And my main concern, it might be other drivers who'd stop to help them get out of the car. Yeah. But the main concern is the marshals. We have the finest marshals in the world in the UK. And they'll put their life on the line to get you out of a car in an incident. And therefore, there is a set time, exactly the same as an able-bodied person, to be able to get out of that car in 7 seconds, from being strapped in to being outside the car. If they're disabled, it doesn't matter if they drop themselves on the ground alongside the car, the marshal can then grab them and get them away.
Yeah.
And it doesn't put that marshal at risk. So having set up that assessment, agreed with the insurance company, all the safety criteria, we then had a procedure for other disabled drivers. And I've done assessments of more than 300 over the last 26 years that I've been doing that for the MSA.
Knowing now how David has made it possible for disabled drivers to compete in motorsport, I want to know what is the secret that motivates him to keep pushing forward in life.
I think I'm very disciplined. And when I set myself a goal, I mean to make that goal regardless of the difficulties or barriers that are put up in front of me. And I think that's necessary for someone with any sort of disability. When I talk to soldiers who've been injured, particularly in Afghanistan, where they've stepped on IEDs, the improvised explosive devices, those guys I always sit and chat to them about what's important. And there's two things, really. And they understand the discipline because they've been in the forces. But it's really to keep yourself fit. Mm-hmm. As I swim probably 2 miles a week.
Yeah.
And I take my lovely Labradors for a walk every night. But also, it's necessary to keep your weight absolutely level. My wife hates me saying this, bless her heart, but I'm exactly the same weight I was when I was 21. I'm now 73.
Yeah.
Because it's essential. You can't put weight on with your artificial limbs. You'll sink into the sockets, which is damn painful, mm-hmm. And you won't be able to walk. So, you must be disciplined in those two areas, fitness and weight. And to be stubborn.
Stubborn, yeah, definitely.
It took me 30 years to get my race licence, so I think you call that stubborn. Or yeah. Persistent, anyway.
Persistence, isn't it? That's what it is. It's like trying to push forward all the time.
And don't let other people tell you what you can't do.
Okay, yeah.
Because some of the soldiers, they would say to me, oh, so-and-so said I can't do this or I can't do that. I said, how disabled are they? He said, oh, they're not. Then how do they know? You set your objectives, you set your what motivates you, and you go and do it.
Don't take
any notice of anybody else.
Yeah, you're going to get me back driving, David. That's what's got to happen.
So, of course.
Some point soon it will happen. It's my new aim now.
Absolutely.
That's what's going to be happening. Do you suffer with anxiety from the bomb at all now?
No, I never have.
No.
I think if there is an age to have such a major injury, probably 11 is it. Because I didn't have... All I was thinking about, could I kick a football again?
Yeah.
These young soldiers who I see, they have enormous anxiety and stress because how are they going to secure a job? How they're going to support a family?
Yeah.
So they have a very different approach. I went to visit some of the victims of the Guildford bombing, and one of them, Paul, was a triple amputee, similar to myself.
Yeah.
He was only 18. Mm. He'd only been married a year, had a little son, and of course, when you go to see these folks very shortly after their injury, as your eardrums are blown out by the blast. So I was really having to shout. Incidentally, I had a very amusing invitation. Paul's doctor rang me and said, David, Prince Charles came to see Paul yesterday. Would you mind coming in soon and cheering him up? Well, I'm sure he didn't mean that, but I did have to chuckle. But I was chatting to Paul, and of course I'm having to shout to him. And I really wasn't getting through. He's very depressed, bless him. And I thought, hang on, David, he's only 18. He's only been married shortly. And I says to him, Paul, there's no problem with sex. And he went, oh. And I thought, oh, that's the problem. I said, oh, take your legs off. You can get in all sorts of different positions, back of a mini. Of course, he was roaring with laughter.
You got to laugh, haven't you?
And as I was leaving, the big SAS guy who was guarding these folks pulled the curtains back. And as I walked past him, he said, David, there's a young nurse over there. Wants your telephone number.
In 2012, as part of the lead-up to the London Olympic and Paralympic Games, David incredibly carried the Olympic torch through his local town to massive crowds of people. I wonder how he felt carrying the torch and what have been some of his incredible, memorable moments in his life.
That was a very emotional occasion, the Olympic torch. I thought that the torch going round the country as it did and having so many people take part in that, it was a very good promotional activity for the Paralympics and the Olympic Games themselves. I was asked to carry the torch in my hometown, Hemel Hempstead, and I did so right through the centre of the town. And although it was raining that day, Andy Murray was on the centre court in the final at Wimbledon. He didn't win that year. The British Grand Prix was on. And 100,000 people turned out to watch. They were 15 deep in places.
Wow.
All my family, my extended family in the United States, my elder daughter and my grandson came over.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful occasion.
Oh, yeah, really,
I thought a great build-up to the Olympics.
Excellent. And you've met the Queen?
Yes, I was very, very proud indeed to gain an MBE for my activities in disability sport. Again, a wonderful occasion. Both my daughters and my wife, they look fabulous. We went to Gordon Ramsay's afterwards and the whole place stopped when we walked in. I was so proud. The Queen's such she makes you feel very, very comfortable when you're talking to her. But before we actually went to gain the medal, we were in the portrait room where they explain to you the exact process, and you literally they lay out exactly where the Queen's going to stand and where you're going to stand, and then you walk up. And then they practice it. And at that point, they said, then you walk backwards away from Her Majesty. Well, I'd never walked backwards before.
Yeah.
And I was sitting next to, I think he was the principal of Westminster School, who had a walking stick as well. And both of us looked at each other and I said, can you walk backwards? And he said, well, I don't know. Anyway, we had the whole place in fits of laughter because the two of us were walking backwards up and down this portrait room to make sure we didn't fall over.
Yeah.
My wife said that when the Queen gave me the MBE, she watched like a hawk as I walked backwards. And she said, I think someone must have told her that you weren't used to doing that and she was keeping an eye on you. But a wonderful occasion.
Now that we've heard all about David's motorsport achievements, carrying the Olympic torch and receiving his MBE from the Queen, I wondered what advice David would give to other people going through a similar life-changing situation, like the one he went through at the age of 11.
I think to realistically assess what they continue to be capable of doing. And by realistic, I mean there are certain things that if you have amputations or a paralysis of some sort, you will not be able to continue entirely as you were before. And therefore, it's necessary to make that adjustment. If you don't, you'll be frustrated and anxious forevermore.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get over that hump, as it were, of saying, okay, that was what I did yesterday, this is what I'm capable of doing today, and there are opportunities. If I hadn't been injured, I would probably never have been into motor racing. I probably would never have done some of the things that, you know, I've absolutely loved doing.
You've been so successful doing that. It's
well, and
fantastic.
I've enjoyed it, but yeah. I don't think I probably wouldn't have done that otherwise. I found that the challenges that came to me from my disability had a major impact on my business career.
Mm-hmm.
Because I took the challenges that challenges that came from my disability into my business life, because I didn't accept that things couldn't change, and that I would set up objectives in business in the same way and the same discipline way as I did getting over my own disability.
Disability has been in the headlines recently. Do you think people have changed their ways in how they're reacting to disability nowadays?
I think the 2012 Paralympics had a major short-term change in attitude, because it showed very positively what disabled people were capable of doing. I feel also the very much the publicity around the Premier League and modifying the stadiums for disabled people, for wheelchair, for ambulance use, has also had a great deal of publicity. Sadly, I'm not sure that it is a permanent change. I think it has to be a very gradual change. And when you get inspiring individuals like young Billy Munger, who lost his legs at Donington and is now back in racing in Formula 3, those sort of stories make people think again about disability and how some people are able to overcome the disability. However, if you take sort of football matches, often disabled people, fans in wheelchairs, are quite often abused because, you know, they're seen to be in the way when the crowds are leaving or whatever. And sometimes people are not very tolerant, frankly. And I sometimes wish I could actually stick somebody in a wheelchair and say, "Now you try it." I find that in places like London Airport, Terminal 3 recently, I got off an aircraft from Madrid, and there was I use a wheelchair there because it's such long distance to walk, and then they transferred me to a buggy, and then I sat there for 15 minutes waiting for other people
and leave
in
there
in the buggy,
and
then we had to transfer again before we go. And by the time I got to where my wife was in the baggage hall, it was probably 30 minutes. Everyone else had gone. And I thought that was extremely poor service. And that does happen quite often.
Absolutely. Now, I know my friend who's who's disabled, and she really, really struggles. And in London in particular, you think that would be better, but it's
but
not.
But it's not. No. I often think companies that offer services, let's take Heathrow again, I'd really like to get the CEO of those companies, stick him in a wheelchair, put a cast on his leg so it looks the job, disguise him so they don't know who it is, and see actually how he feels being treated that way.
Yeah, it's terrible.
I don't think they'll do that. It's a great shame. They'd get a great deal of kudos if they did it and then made some actual changes.
You've been listening to The Longest Battle here on RNIB Connect Radio with me, Emma Martins, and my guest, the incredible and amazing David Butler. To find out more about my own Longest Battle and to hear about other podcast episodes, please visit my website, thelongestbattle.co.uk.